So what do you want to hack for, Bickle?
I can't sleep nights.
How's your driving record?
It's clean. It's real clean, like my patches.
I'm working long hours now. 6 in the afternoon to 6 in the morning, sometimes even 8 in the morning. All the animals come out at night. Whores, skunk pussies, buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies, sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets.
I don't believe I've ever met anyone quite like you.
Loneliness has followed me my whole life. Everywhere. In bars and cars. Sidewalks, stores, everywhere. There's no escape. And God's the only man.
You're in a hell, and you're gonna die in a hell like the rest
of us. Come on now, there's a cop across the street.
You're like the rest of us.
I just wanna go out. I really... You know, I really wanna... I got some bad ideas in my head, I just...
You looking for some action?
Yeah.
You see that guy over there? You go talk to him, his name is Matthew.
I'll see you later, copper.
I'm no cop, man.
Why do you want me to go back to my parents? I mean, they hate me.
Yeah, but you can't live like this. It's a hell.
So what makes you so high and mighty? Will you tell me that? Didn't you ever try looking at your own eyeballs in the mirror?
You talking to me?
Suck on this.
You talking to me?
Hey!
You talking to me?
You crazy son of a bitch! Fucking son of a bitch, you! I'll kill you! I'll kill you!
Then who the hell else are you talking? You talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
At some point in your life, you've experienced loneliness, and loneliness can be a dangerous thing if you feel ostracized from the world. And Travis Bickle, the main character in Taxi Driver, is the whole metaphor of everything is about loneliness and being alone in the world's biggest city and what that can do to someone's mind and cloud things. And so the film is basically about a young man who is kind of lost in this fantasy, delusional world that he's kind of culture shocked by, trying to be a part of it, trying to fit in, trying to be ordinary, but he can't. And it's causing paranoia. It's causing all kinds of emotions in him to the point where it's pushing him towards acting out in a possibly violent or very violent way. And it's about, is he going to be able to control that, or is he going to completely lose a battle with his sanity?
Hello, and welcome back to Scream Addicts. I'm Jason Jenkins, call me Jinx, and that was Nathan Thomas Milliner talking about Martin Scorsese's 1976 classic, Taxi Driver. Mr. Milliner is an artist and filmmaker who has created original artwork for both Horror Hound Magazine and Scream Factory, where he provided new cover art for such titles as The Funhouse, The Burning, and Halloween's 2 and 3. In addition, he wrote and directed the short film The Confession of Fred Krueger and the feature A Wish for the Dead. Mr. Milliner, thanks so much for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, as with every episode, and as with every guest, I have to ask, of any horror movie you might have chosen to discuss, why go with Taxi Driver? And furthermore, could you explain why you see Taxi Driver as a horror film?
Well, you know, you could pick the same things everybody talks about, you know, obvious choices. And you'd sent me a list of things you had talked about before, and you had done an episode on No Country for Old Men, which is one of my favorite films of all time, and definitely one of those movies that kind of brings up the question, is it horror or is it not? So when I saw that, I was like, how often is Taxi Driver discussed on a horror podcast? When discussing horror films, probably not often, because a lot of people just see it as a drama. But it's so much more, and it was so highly influenced by horror. Martin Scorsese has said that the movie was, he shot it as if he were shooting a horror film, like a German expressionist horror film. Cinematography, everything's kind of, it's a character study, and I don't know, the character of Travis Bickle is a very frightening figure. He is, you know, he's one step away from being the boogeyman in many ways, because you don't know what he's capable of. He's unpredictable to others and to himself, and you know, he's moving towards violence. It's a slow portrait. You just change a little bit of, you know, There's Norman Bates and Travis Bickle. There's all kinds of characters, famous horror characters. I mean, Psycho and Hitchcock in general was a huge influence on the film as well. So a lot of the influences on Scorsese was there. And I think, you know, he chose Bernard Herrmann to score it, who was very famous for his Hitchcock scores and horror scores. And I think it's there. I think, you know, maybe not right in your face horror. It's not, I mean, what is horror? I mean, horror is such a different, like, by the 1970s, horror was becoming something else anyway. And, you know, before the 1970s, horror was, you know, gothic horror. It was taking place in Transylvania. It was taking place in, you know, graveyards and big manors and stuff. And by the 60s and 70s, horror had become more Americanized. Clive Barker had said that the arrest of Ed Gein in 1958 kind of Americanized horror, where, you know, shortly Robert Bloch wrote his book Psycho, Hitchcock made Psycho. So now people weren't afraid of Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. They were afraid of the guy next door who was digging up bodies and, you know, wearing people's faces at night and shooting the hardware store lady. So Travis Bickle is that character. He's that dark drifter figure that you don't know what he's capable of doing. I think he's definitely a horror figure.
Yeah, I agree entirely. And, you know, plus looking at the movie, I rewatching it for this chat and sort of, you know, viewing it through that filter of it being a horror film. You know, you mentioned the older school of horror film, you know, with concerned with graveyards and manors and, you know, what we think of when we think of Hammer horror. And when the movie opens, you know, the opening almost seems almost gothic in a way, you know, that fog and smoke sort of giving way to the taxi that slowly rolls through it, like it's, you know, it's the star of the movie or the creature of the piece. But you're right, like after it opens that way, it sort of very quickly dispenses with all of that and becomes something very gritty and grimy and realistic and very much something that we consider coming from the 70s. It feels very much of that era. And yeah, I mean, you know, shortly thereafter we meet Travis Bickle, you know, this guy who's just wanting to land work driving a taxi. And, you know, I mean, I know this was, what, nearly a decade before Maniac, but I mean, Joe Spinell is his boss, you know, which,
oh yeah, he's in it.
Yeah, exactly. When he is the normal guy, you know, cast against, you know, Travis Bickle, I mean, we know that something must be very, very wrong with our lead character. You know, I mean, it's the maniac is his boss, you know, no less, but, you know, we can sort of tell straight away that, you know, Travis is, you know, he's charming in a way, but he's also deeply damaged. You know, he might very well be a precursor to Spinell's maniac, you know, it, and it's funny if you watch Maniac, I mean, you're right. You had mentioned this earlier that it is very clear that Maniac is descended from Taxi Driver. You know, Travis Bickle is only a step or two away from being a serial killer, you know? But it's funny,
if Travis killed a bunch of people in the movie, everybody would say, oh, yeah, it's a horror film.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you could compare it to Henry. Henry, you know, you could compare it to that, John McNaughton's movie. It's just, you know, a character portrait of sociopath. Travis is a sociopath, and what's he going to do? Is he capable of being a bad person or being a good person? I had read something about, you know, what allows someone to be a, Richard Kuklinski, when he did the Iceman confession interviews in the 90s on HBO, he talked to that psychiatrist, and he was a hitman for the mafia, and he didn't understand why he was the way he was. And the guy said, well, you know, there's this thing about the sociopath where it's a fearlessness, because you're not afraid of anything. You're not worried about dying or getting hurt yourself. So you're able to do these things because you don't care. You don't feel fear. Because it's also the same exact thing that firefighters and soldiers and policemen feel who run into a burning building to save someone. They don't think about it. That same instinct is very reflective of the sociopath or the psycho killer. You know, the person who can kill without remorse. And I kind of think of the movie The Vanishing as well when I think of that. The character who, you know, he saves a kid from drowning and everybody's treating him like a hero. So he starts to wonder, if I'm capable of doing something like that, am I capable of doing something awful as well? And then he does what he does in the film. So I think that's kind of how Travis is, and that's how Travis plays out. At the end, does he become the monster who assassinates the politician, or does he become the hero who saves the 12-year-old girl from her pimp? And he's really neither. He could be either one, and that's what's really frightening about him, is he didn't do it to be a hero. He just wanted attention. He wanted to make a noise. He wanted people to see him because he was invisible.
Yeah, and I think that's why he chose Palantine, you know, the presidential candidate in a way. Or, you know, did he? I mean, you know, early on he meets Sybil Shepherd's character, Betsy, and he becomes smitten with her. He asks her out, and ultimately, you know, she sort of spurns him, and it sends him kind of spiraling throughout the course of the movie. But later, when he targets Palantine, who's a presidential candidate Betsy was campaigning for, I mean, when he was courting her, he seemed to be all for Palantine. You know, he even had a friendly conversation with him in his taxi, you know. But once Betsy's gone, Palantine lands in Travis's crosshairs. Now, is that merely because he's aware of Palantine and he wants to make a lot of noise with whatever violent act he commits, so he chooses somebody who's very visible to the public? Or is it, do you think, merely a way to strike back at Betsy in a way?
Well, Paul Schrader mentioned that it's kind of, he's definitely someone who has trouble with authority. He doesn't like authority. And who's the ultimate authority figure but the father figure? And Palantine is kind of the father figure of Betsy. She looks up to him like a father in many ways. I mean, she says he's sexy and all that, so there's also a little attraction there from her. But to Travis, he is the male in her life that she's obsessed with, that she doesn't look at him the way she's looking at this guy. And in the same way with Keitel's character, Sport, he's the father figure in Iris's life. And he's going to strike either one or the other father figure between these two women. And, you know, I guess that's why he does it. And he, you know, and you could even go into real life where, you know, John Hinckley shot Reagan because of this film, because he became obsessed with Jodie Foster and he wanted to impress her and get her attention. And, you know, maybe it's kind of the same thing, you know, art imitating life that actually happened in response to this film. Of course, this film was inspired as well by the real life Arthur Bremer, who shot George Wallace in 72. Paul Schrader was reading his diaries, who, you know, committed an assassination as well. I think it was just, you know, again, he's an invisible character and he wants to, you know, lash out and show. And maybe like that final scene, you know, there's a lot of talk about the final scene where Betsy gets in his cab. And what does that mean? Did it happen or did it not happen? Or is this like his revenge of like, oh, she gets in and now she wants to talk to him. Now she's looking at him differently because now he's a hero. He's somebody because of something he did. So I don't know. It's just, that's what's so interesting about this film. I've watched it so many times and I still don't fully grasp everything that's going on because there's so much there. There's so much intelligence behind, you know, you got so much intelligence in Schrader and Scorsese and De Niro. It's just kind of amazing trio of people like right there when they were hungry and wanting to show what they could do. And it's possibly the best thing any of them have done, which is saying a lot with those three guys.
Agreed. Absolutely. And, you know, looking at Travis, you know, by himself, we are sort of, I think, immediately set sort of ill at ease with him, you know, not just in that opening scene with Spinell where he's pitching himself to the job. I mean, we can sort of tell that there's something wrong with him. But as the movie progresses, pretty early on, we find ourselves sort of privy to Travis's thoughts with, you know, the constant inner monologue that he has going on. And, you know, early on, I think we start to realize that we might be getting a glimpse into the mind of a psychopath. And, you know, not long after, he is set up as a stalker after he catches sight of Betsy. You know, there's that first great shot of her where she appears practically angelic. And, you know, we're wondering where this could possibly go. But, you know, in getting to know him, he isn't completely unsympathetic. You know, I mean, he is he is potentially a psychopath. He is a racist. He is violent and prone to violent outbursts. And there is something incredibly wrong with him. But at the same time, we find out that, you know, he's a veteran. You know, he came back from Vietnam. He was honorably discharged, or at least, you know, so he says. And he's a guy who appears to have been hollowed out by the war. You know, you look at his eyes. He seems wounded.
He's got insomnia. You know? He's not, you know, that's why he's driving a taxi. He can't sleep. And it's yeah, it's definitely, you know, I kind of see, I haven't heard anybody say this for a while, but at some point it seems like I heard that he's from the Midwest. And so he's probably from a small town that didn't really, probably never even saw a black person before or a Hispanic person or anything. So he's like shipped off to Vietnam as a Marine to kill. And, you know, of course, you know, we all know about how, you know, these guys come home and they're coming from a life or death situation every day and they're trained to murder and then they try to come back and function as a normal human being. And if Travis was kind of this naive hick, you know, who was ushered into Vietnam, this other world, to kill people, and now all of a sudden he's in New York City in the 1970s, which was kind of a cesspool of just decadence and you know, I mean, you talk to people who are around. I never saw New York City at that point, but you see it on the screen. It's a nightmare. Like going back to the whole haunted house thing, someone described Taxi Driver as New York City is the haunted house, and Travis is in it. And it is the way it's shot. Is you can feel it. You can, like, they just captured kind of a hellish urban nightmare. And he's driving through it, and he's observing it, and he doesn't like what he sees. He's disgusted by people, and he hates them, especially, you know, the pimps, and, you know, and he's, you know, I think that's why I connected with the movie, why it's become my favorite film. I hope, and I've found from, you know, talking to more and more people, because I'm an introverted person. I'm a very quiet, personal, like, private person. And I was, like, painfully shy growing up. And being an artist as well, you know, you're just kind of different anyway. If you're an artist and writer, you know, you just think differently. You're not interested in the same things that other people are. And you're a watcher. You're an observer, which is what Travis does most of the movies. He's watching Cybill Shepherd. He's watching Jodie Foster. He's watching everybody. And he's looking, you know, he doesn't speak a lot. He just sits there and watches the guys at the cat stand talk. He watches the guys at the diner talk. He watches people walk by, and he's taking things in, and he doesn't really belong. And I remember feeling that way, and I have to imagine a lot of people feel that way, more so than people feel. I mean, everybody wants to belong. I mean, it's really a big part, especially when you're young. They want to fit in, and that's something that Travis really talks about a lot. He says something about, I don't think people should be obsessed with self-attention, but they should become normal, like a normal person, or be like just a person. And I remember feeling that as a young man, as like, I don't know how to fit in. I don't know how to be normal, because I just didn't relate to people, either because of the introvertedness or because I was an artist and I just saw the world differently than other people did. And I identify with Travis through that. And I think it's one of those things where you grow out of it, or you learn to move on. You know, you find love. You find, like, well, my wife is kind of what pulled me out of that dark place I was in as an angry young man who was disgusted by the world. And that's another thing, like, going out into the world, you see what the world is. You see the truth behind it. You know, he doesn't like it. He's like, one day a real rain will come and wash the scum off the earth, off the streets. And so he just really wants to make a noise, and he just doesn't like the people he's stuck with, but he's also fascinated by it. And I don't know. It's just a freaking amazing study that, you know, we're still talking about it 40 years later, and it's still, you know, considered one of the greats and probably the greatest film about a single portrait of a person who's going through being alone and trying to function as a normal person, but just can't do it. Like, whenever he's trying to reach out, when he tries to be with Betsy, he's trying to be the leading man. He's trying to be that guy that deserves this beautiful blonde woman that everybody would desire, but he just can't do it. because he doesn't know how to do it, and he doesn't understand that he's wrong. I take her to a porno. What? There's nothing wrong with this. People come to these. I see people do this all the time. And he's like, and you feel so embarrassed for him, you know, like, because he just wants to, he wants to be normal, and he can't be. So it's a very sad film, of course.
And he does seem
I can say ramble.
No. I agree with you. And, you know, that loneliness is definitely the thread that ties the entire movie together. And it's all right there with Travis and how beaten down he seems by his own condition, I think. You know, he's sort of quick to smile and laugh at times, but it never really seems genuine. And he always appears to be so very lonely, even when he has company, even when he's in public or a crowded room. He's absolutely alone, and the movie very much seems to be, you know, about that isolation. And, you know, there's even that moment when he speaks to Betsy for the first time and he asks her out. You know, he tries that charming shtick of his for a second, but he really seems to win her over when he says, you know, sort of very directly, that she seems to be a lonely person and that she's unhappy. And I wonder, you know, is he projecting onto her, you know, sort of seeing his own loneliness and unhappiness in her, do you think? Or do you think it's actually there and he's able to recognize it in another, you know? Because, I mean, in being lonely, Travis, you know, a man who appears to constantly be talking to himself, or, you know, again, with those inner monologues, you know, he's constantly speaking to himself, you know, he's constantly chattering in his mind. You know, is he looking for a companion that simply mirrors himself in a way? And if so, do you think that that's what dooms their relationship? I mean, again, you mentioned the pornographic movies, and, you know, that's his reasoning. I mean, because he likes watching pornographic movies in seedy theaters, why wouldn't she?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if she's the same as he's thinking she is, because he does. He brings that up. I think you're a lonely person. I think he's projecting what he thinks he's observed from her. But is that really her? I don't think it is. I think it's what he wants her to be, hoping that she'll be. And then he, you know, as far as taking her to the porno film, he just legitimately doesn't understand that that's not okay. That, because he's in, you know, driving down 42nd Avenue in the 70s. It's nothing but grindhouses and porno houses. Like, that's where everybody's going. And he's like, this is how normal people are. They watch these movies, right? This is normal. And, you know, he doesn't understand pop culture. He's not connected with anything. She brings up Kris Kristofferson. He has no idea who that is. You know, but he's watching pop culture all the time. He's always watching soap operas and American Bandstand on the television, which has become my favorite scene in the movie. Is when he's watching American Bandstand, and they're playing Jackson Browne's Late for the Sky, and he's got the .44 Magnum in his hands, and he's just kind of, it's that look on De Niro's face and slow push in on it. That scene to me is where it's all turned. It's all gone. It's all over at this point. He's going to do something. And there's a scene where he's watching American Bandstand. Of course, he focuses on this black couple who's smiling and dancing in front of it. And this, you know, it's one of those things where he wants to be that, but he can't. He doesn't fit. And then I've always been curious about this. I'm sure it was an actual episode of American Bandstand, but it's so perfect. There's that shot of the empty shoes on the dance floor. Yeah, and it's like, that's Travis. He's an empty person. He's invisible. And he's, all these people are going on through life. And I remember feeling that way as well as a young man. It's like, you know, why I'm a good person. Why did all these people found each other and they're in love and they're normal. You know, they're doing all these things that I want to do, or I feel like I'm supposed to do as a normal person, but I'm not. I'm just here in my apartment eating junk food, watching people on TV live life. And I really don't know what life is. I don't know what it is, because I'm just some country hick, you know, who is tossed into this. And I'm trying to get a grasp of what it is. And he even starts to imitate people. When he talks to Iris, it's probably the only time he feels like, maybe it's because she's young, it's one of the only times he feels like, it seems like he is, feels like he's the mentor, or he's the one who's knowledgeable in their situation. But he also doesn't feel like Travis in that movie. He almost seems like he's pretending to be Peter Boyle or the other guys at the cast. And he kind of talks, "Hey man," you know, he's talking all kind of hip, which isn't him. And there's that awkwardness when he talks to Iris. I always felt it was odd where he's talking to Iris and he wants her to go out with him to lunch and talk, and he says, "Hi, I'm Travis Iris, sweet Iris," or something. The way he says it, it seems so disingenuous. Like, it seems like an act.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, he's, like, trying to feel act normal and trying to be a father to this girl, maybe. Like, I don't know, maybe. Like, I tried this girl here, and she's not into it, and I can be maybe a father figure to this girl and get her out of this filth and this cesspool that I'm dealing with.
Do you think he's already planning on trying to be a hero, at least in his own mind, so far as trying to get Iris out of her situation? And if so, do you think that's why he needs to wear another persona in a way? I mean, you mentioned Peter Boyle's character. Maybe he's trying him on almost like a mask because he needs to be somebody else if he is going to be a hero.
Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely missing an identity of himself. So he probably is. When he goes and hits on Betsy, he's pretending to be, you know, he's pretending to be, you know, the leading man in the movie. He's pretending to be that suave guy. I'm dressed up in my suit. I'm waiting. You know, there's that scene where he's walking to say how he's dressed up to ask her out. And Scorsese shot it with the lens where he's in focus. Everyone else is out of focus. And so we're locked in on him. He's still alone. Every time Scorsese shoots him, even though he's in a crowded street, he's alone because he's the only one in focus. Everyone else is like not there. It's a fantasy, and he's trying to be someone else. And again, same thing with Iris. He's, you know, I think he's a moral character. I think he definitely comes from like small town morals. And again, he's culture shocked by what people are doing in New York City, the whole pimp thing. Like, he sees Harvey Keitel and he's just completely disgusted by this guy and probably wants to shoot him right there, you know, kind of thing. He takes pleasure in killing that guy. When he walks up to him at the end, you know, he just got this big grin on his face. "How you doing, sport? How's the pimp business?" You know, it's a brilliant film performance, everything about it. And I can't get enough of it. Every time I go back to it, I could watch it and watch it and still say there's so much to learn and notice from this film. And that's why it's just become my favorite film, because it's just so layered and so, again, I identify with it. Another weird coincidence is the movie was released the year I was born, 1976, and the very first journal entry he has is May 10th, which is my birthday.
Oh wow.
So I was like, May 10th is my 1976 is my birthday, the day I was born. So it's there's this weird kinship there. I have this weird like my third favorite movie of all time is Days of Confused, which takes place in May of 1976. But and it's like, it's not like I searched out to be fans of those films, but for some reason there's this link that I just gravitated towards these films.
So can I ask the first time that you caught Taxi Driver? I'm guessing, was it VHS?
Yeah, and I saw it late. I didn't see it as a young man. I saw it probably my freshman year in college.
Oh, wow, okay.
I watched movies growing up. I was obsessed with them, but I wasn't a film guy. Like, I was like every other teenager. I liked watching movies, but I was only exposed to what my family watched or what was in the theaters or what... I got into horror, so I was seeing a lot of old horror movies. I got into that around age 12 and was renting every horror movie I could get. But watching, you know, Taxi Driver was probably not on my list of movies as a, you know, young kid. And when I got into college, I met a guy who was really into film that I worked with and went to school with. And he turned me on to a lot of stuff that I had, the Independence. He turned me on to Reservoir Dogs, which was huge at that point. It was right before Pulp Fiction came out. But if you were a film nerd, it was all about Reservoir Dogs and Tarantino at that point, because he had just kind of changed how people were making films. Like, and because Tarantino was so into violent, ultra-violent films, when you get into Tarantino, you get into, all right, what else do I need to watch? I need to watch Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. I need to watch Stanley Kubrick's The Clockwork Orange. I need to watch Bonnie and Clyde, and I need to watch the Godfather films. And, you know, there's that list of movies when you get into, like, ultra-violent film that you need to seek out, and Taxi Driver's on that list. And that's how I came to it.
I even remember it being mentioned in a Fangoria once when I was a teenager. Somebody was talking in an article about that sort of explosion of violence at the end of Taxi Driver. I think that was the first time I'd ever heard of it, even as a young film fan. I was like, what the hell is Taxi Driver? And it doesn't sound like a horror movie. It doesn't sound scary at all. But yeah, that ending is truly horrifying, and you can completely understand why it would be mentioned in the pages of Horror Magazine.
It became such a counterculture part of, like the punk movement was around, like, shortly after that, like 1977, and that was 1 year after Taxi Driver. So the punk, you know, because he shaved his mohawk kind of thing. I don't know if that's why the punk people started doing the mohawk thing. You know, of course, in the movie, it was because someone mentioned to Scorsese that sometimes before a battle, some of the Vietnam soldiers, there was a couple of guys who were going into the shit, and they would, you know, shave their head in a mohawk to prep themselves up for battle, I guess, like a Comanche or something. So, but, you know, I know that the punk crowd really took Travis and Taxi Driver. I mean, The Clash did a song about it, and it became, it's just one of those things, like, Alex DeLarge and The Clockwork Orange, Travis Bickle and Taxi Driver are just part of the counterculture of film and outsiders, and, you know, the people who buck authority, and the rebels, the rebel rousers. And as a young person, you kind of gravitate towards, you know, I think a lot of young people are angry. We get really angry at the world because you're having to face the world and having to grow up. You know, this isn't fair. You know, I got to, so you just get angry, and you're, and it's this part, this kind of transition that you go through, and you listen to angry music, you listen to heavy metal, you watch horror movies, you watch anything that's on the outside, that's not mainstream, that's not square, I guess. And, you know, Taxi Driver fits into that thing, and I just started watching that, you know, John Woo films and things at that point. And Taxi Driver didn't have it didn't hit me when I first saw it. I watched it, and being, you know, 18, 19, it was like, it was all about that last scene, that violent scene. Yeah, that was cool. You know, he's shooting all these people in his blood, and he's using his finger as a gun, and got the blood, and, you know, got a mohawk, he looks cool. And, you know, now, you know, as an older man, I watch it, and it's not about that at all. It's so much more about the psychology and everything else. And, you know, again, my favorite scene is just him sitting watching TV, you know, watching American Bandstand, because there's so much going on with, as a filmmaker as well. You know, once I became a filmmaker, you even start to take that stuff even more serious. Like, you're looking beyond what's exciting. You know, at that point in the time, like Reservoir Dogs, my favorite thing about Reservoir Dogs was the torture scene. You know, now I don't even give a shit about the torture scene. But, you know, at 18, I was like, hey, he's cutting the guy's ear off and dancing the Steelers wheel. This is cool. And, you know, because at that point, you're it's the same thing with horror in general. And I think that's probably relatable to horror. Is I remember when I got into horror, because I didn't grow up on horror because my parents didn't really watch it. I didn't have any older siblings or anyone who watched it. The most I would see was, like, Twilight Zone, the movie, or Poltergeist, you know, kind of the more mainstream Steven Spielberg kind of stuff. And it was when I saw like Return of the Living Dead and Nightmare on Elm Street and stuff around the mid 80s, where I was gravitating towards it because I was becoming an introverted, shy kid who felt like I needed somewhere to belong, something that was for me, that nobody else was into kind of thing. But you see that in a lot of loners and outsiders anyway, where they gravitate towards, you know, it could be The Cure or, you know, the Sex Pistols or whatever it is that's on the left. You know, it's not what everybody else is into.
You might very well be describing me as a teen.
Yeah, I mean, I think all horror fans were there. I think we all have that common link of we were looking for something for us that nobody else had, and things that were taboo and off limits. So we weren't supposed to be watching this stuff. We weren't supposed to be listening to NWA or Metallica or Slayer. And we weren't supposed to be watching Cannibal Holocaust. We weren't supposed to be watching this, you know, A Spit on Your Grave. We're not supposed to be seeing this excess of nudity and violence and aggression. And that is very compelling and attractive to a young person who is trying to find themselves, trying to fit in, but also doesn't find they fit in, and is also full of anger. It's a good thing. That's also a possible bad thing, where you get someone like Travis Bickle, who's exposed to things that's triggering him.
Well, I wonder though, in our case, or at least, you know, speaking just of myself, like, you know, having those horror films and having a certain type of music and reading comics in my case or whatever, it was all very cathartic in a way. And in watching Taxi Driver and sort of viewing it, you know, through that prism, again, looking at it as kind of a horror film, that is one thing that I noticed about Travis this time is, you know, he really doesn't have any outlet like that. You know, American Bandstand, I don't think really counts, you know, for him. You know, it's something to just...
He has no hobbies.
Yeah, he has no hobbies. He has nothing but just his... you know, his thoughts, and he is so completely alone. And I wonder if, you know, damn it, instead of like hanging out in like CD pornographic theaters, if he had gone to the theater to catch The Exorcist, you know, would he be
like
a little more mentally
healthy?
Chainsaw
Massacre is playing there. You see it on the marquee in the one shot. It's like, he should have just went and saw Chainsaw Massacre and he'd be fine.
Absolutely. I think he would be better, you know?
Yeah, because there is that one thing where people say, you know, like people are afraid of horror fans. Oh, they're crazy. They're sick. There's something wrong with them that they like to watch that stuff. But like you said, it's cathartic. I think it's healthier to be exposed to that kind of thing, because we as a species have those tendencies, that bloodlust, because it was part of our nature. You know, 100 years ago or 150 years ago, we saw death far more frequently. You know, if someone died in our household, we took care of the bodies. We buried them. We prepped them. We had to go out and hunt and butcher our meat. It was part of human nature, was violence. And we don't get that. You know, we go get our food at the grocery store, and we turn our dead over to the more, you know, the professionals. And we're not around death, and we're not around blood and guts and butchering and things. And so when we watch it in the news or in film, because film is fantasy, we watch it, we're safe. We know we're safe. We know those people aren't really dying. I don't know if you're like this, but I'm like this. I'm not a big fan of real life violence. I don't like watching the news. I don't like watching MMA or boxing. I don't like if I'm driving by a car accident, I don't slow down to look at it. I don't want to see that stuff. I care about people.
And it's so completely disturbing.
I've noticed that a lot.
I found, even as I've gotten older, like, you know, as a young kid, I suppose there was sort of the desire to see, you know, what was taboo. And, you know, what young burgeoning sort of horror fan doesn't want to watch Faces of Death, you know, just to see if they can handle it or see what they can watch. But now, like, you know, my God, last week that poor older gentleman got shot, you know, in Cleveland. And they showed just the opening part of that on... you know, like the evening news, and it destroyed me for the damn week. You know, I mean, there was no act of violence shown on screen or whatever. We're only, you know, we know what happened after, but just the lead up to it and the fact that guy was gone so senselessly, like, that completely and utterly unhinged me for a couple of days. Well, not unhinged me, that's a wrong word to say, but I mean, I was deeply depressed over that for a couple of days. And yet, you know, I can watch any horror movie where people are chainsawed or blown apart or stabbed. And it's, you know, I can shrug at that. If anything, I, you know, if they're horror comedies, I can giggle my way through it, you know. But yeah, I know what you mean. And it is, you know, I did want to ask, you mentioned the notion of getting older and like watching these movies, and when you're younger, you kind of enjoy the more violent parts of them. But as you get older, you know, they take on more meaning. You can sort of parse out what the filmmakers were trying to say. And, you know, in talking about horror fans finding catharsis through watching violent images like we are, I got to ask, do you think Travis, you know, obviously he didn't have any outlets like that, and he kind of kept himself from them, I think. But after he commits his big act of violence, the thing that he was building to for all that time, you know, he murders all of those guys to save Iris, but not really. I don't think it was really an altruistic event. It was just, that was nearest port. You know,
It was a flip of a coin. If he hadn't been spotted in that crowd, he would have shot Palantine and he'd be,
and that would have been it,
you know, arrested.
But
he wouldn't have. I don't think he set out to be a hero, and I don't think it's going to change him. He will do this again.
Okay, something that's what I was going to ask. Like, do you think that was a purging event for him, or do you think he's kind of like, you know, if we're not going to class him as a serial killer, I mean, he could, you know, there is that tendency, well, it's not even a tendency, it's what they are, but with serial killers, you know, they there is that compulsion to kill, and then they're fine for a while, and then it builds back up, and they need to sort of release that pressure again, you know, open that valve. And do you think that is going to be the case with Travis? Like, he's fine for, and that's assuming that he is still alive at the end of the movie, and we can discuss that in a minute. But if we're to take the movie at face value, and he's out there on the streets again, and he was hailed as a hero for saving this young girl, do you think he is eventually going to have to kill again? Will he have that need to do something violent or something big in a way again?
I do think so. I think there's been talk that, you know, I mean, when at that ending where he does that double take of his reflection in the mirror, that's an indication that things aren't right with Travis still, and this is all going to start over. And, you know, when I think about it now, and I've never thought about this before, you know, he acted out because he wanted to be seen. He wanted people to notice him, which you see a lot of in reality when people do something. They just want to be noticed, and because they feel invisible and no one cares and they're meaningless. And I'm going to make something. I'm going to do something. Because he's, you know, he's talking to Peter Boyle. You know, I don't know. I got some real bad ideas. You know, I got some real bad thoughts.
It's almost a cry for help.
I think he is. I think he's definitely asking someone to say, "Please help me, man, because I'm afraid of what I'm going to do." And when Peter Boyle's character is kind of just a big bullshitter. You know, he just kind of bullshits. And when he's presented with something that's real serious, he does. He becomes kind of like, I don't know. And he starts telling the story that makes no sense. Like, he's just trying to feel the intense, like the awkward space of what's going on, and Travis is just kind of like, I don't know, man, that sounds like the dumbest thing I ever heard. Like, I don't, you're not really, you're trying too hard. But I think he has like the pictures of himself in the paper that he cut out of being a hero, and he has the letter from Iris's parents framed or hanging up, and so I'm looking at it from a fame point of view of, you know, when you become famous, when you do get that notoriety, you want to hold on to it and you don't want it to go. And I think that could be his downfall as well, as leading him back to this, is that he's gotten attention. Now he's going to either fall back into obscurity because it's just his 15 minutes of fame. Nobody's really going to, like, oh, you're that guy that did that. You know, they're going to forget him in a year or, you know, a month or two. And I think there's going to be that time where he's like, I want that notoriety again. I want to be noticed again. I got to do something else again so people don't forget about me or don't remember me. And I think I've never thought of it that way. But, you know, being around a lot of famous people who don't have their fame anymore in the last 2 years, and also dealing with my own, I'm not famous, but like I'm known, and there is this thing where you need to keep that going because it's your career, it's your livelihood in many ways. But if people forget you, they'll replace you. And you want to stay relevant because, so you got to keep working. You got to keep doing things. And, you know, Travis is doing things, is shooting people and not drawing posters. You know? So
I don't think
we're
going to
shoot now because they're forgetting about me.
Now, do
luckily,
you think...
I draw posters and don't shoot people. But...
Do you think Travis, because his notoriety that he ultimately got for his big violent act, because he was seen as a hero, do you think he's going to gravitate towards something like that again, trying to save someone? Or do you think he's going to reset to zero and it doesn't matter what he does, he just needs to do something big and violent to somebody in the public
eye?
Yeah,
he may try to repeat what he did before, and he'll probably fall on his face. He'll probably do something. There was something else. One of the big influences on the film was The Searchers, John Ford's film, where, you know, John Wayne, who had always played the hero, was playing kind of an anti-hero for the first time, a very questionable guy. And in that movie, John Wayne is obsessed with saving Natalie Wood, who's been kidnapped by the Indians. He thinks he's on this mission of heroism to save her, but the thing is, she doesn't really want to be saved. When he finds her, she's actually like happy to be where she is. And Travis is reflecting of that care of Ethan. He wants to save this young girl, but a lot of the times you look at Jodie Foster and she doesn't want to be saved. She's like, she loves sport. You know, she has those moments where she, you know, she has a fight with him, get in the car, drive me away, cabby. But I don't know if she really wanted to go back home to her, you know, her boring family.
I think the last line that she has is "Don't shoot him," you know, talking about one of the, you know, her handlers, you know, and it's like this is somebody, you're right, who didn't want to be saved, and yet that didn't matter to Travis. I don't think for a moment he thought he was doing something heroic. He'll tell himself that later. Maybe he was even trying to convince himself of it then, but. No, it's much like the guy that he shot in the convenience store. You know, he didn't care about the convenience store owner. You know, he just saw an excuse to do something violent, and he took it. And I think it's the same thing with Iris.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think he was, he did that because he wanted to. He just had an itchy finger, itchy trigger finger. Because he's, you know, he's playing make-believe. He's in a fantasy, you know, that's the whole mirror scene where he's talked to himself when he's practicing what he's going to say and how he's going to do things. You know, he's pretending. He's being an actor. He just continues to watch and observe, and then he pretends to be the leading man, pretends to be the father savior. He pretends to be the badass with the guns who will take on anybody. You know, what did you say to me? Huh? Yeah, really? You know, I got you. So,
it's funny you pointed that out too. Like, I definitely wanted to talk about that moment for a second before we finish here. You know, it's the most iconic scene in the film. It's the one that's quoted over and over. You know, you talking to me? You talking to me? But
yeah.
I remember Roger Ebert pointing out in a review once that line, you know, the one that everyone repeats, you know, you talking to me. That's not the most important line in that scene. It's the one right after. Well, there's no one else here, you know? Yeah. And it's like, yeah, that really, yeah, it's that cuts to the core of who he is. You know, that's what the movie is about right there in that moment, is a guy just staring at himself in the mirror saying, there's nobody else here.
So many amazing lines that Paul Schrader wrote. Of course, he didn't write "You Talking to Me," but like all the stuff like, you know, listen, you fuckers, you screwheads, here's a man that would not take it anymore. You know, stood up against the shit, the filth, the scum, all that. And here's someone who stood up, you know, here is. And he kind of just goes dot, dot, dot. And
what do you think the wrongs are that are being leveled at Travis as he perceives it, do you think? Like when he talks about, you know, here's a man who would not take it anymore, do you think he's trying to search for a reason to excuse the way he feels? And if so, like what do you think he sees out there in the world that's, you know,
he's putting his failures on other people. He's making excuses. I remember something that Paul Schrader said about it, about the racism. He said that you know, there's definitely racism still in the movie. And at the end, you know, the pimp was supposed to be black and everything, and they decided to change it because they really didn't want to go there with, like, the Travis just kills a bunch of black people. So that's why they made the pimp white, because they didn't want it to seem overly racist and be that controversial. Although there probably were no white pimps. They said they tried to find a white pimp for Harvey to meet, and there were no white pimps anywhere around. But he was talking about racism and how people who are racist, people who are racist, like, the racism is someone who's so low on the totem pole that they're always trying to mess with the person below them on the totem pole. And Travis is low on the totem pole, and in his mind, who's below him are the black people, the Hispanic people. That's where racism comes. You're putting someone below you, but you're low yourself. So Travis is a loser in life. He's a loser, completely loser. And he's angry about his station in life, and he's trying to find someone to blame it on. Why is my life suck? It's because of the blacks. It's because of the Hispanics. It's because of these people. These people are ruining everything. He goes, that's where racism comes from. It comes from losers in life who are looking to project that anger and that someone to blame and put the blame on their shortcomings and their failures in life. It's not my fault that I, you know, didn't go to school and get a good job, didn't try harder and all that. It's because the blacks are taking my jobs, or the Hispanics are taking my jobs.
Bad hombres, right?
Because of them. Those bad hombres, you know. And I think that's what Paul Schrader was talking. He said, I think that's what it is. It's like, Travis is a loser. He's a complete loser. He is a nobody. He will never amount to anything. He's drifting through life. He's getting by. And he's angry. He's angry because that's where he's stuck. And he has to find someone to blame for it.
And Schrader definitely seemed to be very interested in that notion, the idea of a Vietnam vet who was also a racist, who was kind of a ticking time bomb, because he also, are you familiar with a movie called Rolling Thunder?
Oh, yeah. Love it.
Amazing, amazing film. And it's funny, I happened across a first draft of the script that Schrader wrote. Schrader only wrote the first draft of that movie. And whenever we think of that movie, it's like, oh, Schrader wrote Rolling Thunder, you know, right around the same time that he wrote Taxi Driver. And it's funny, in reading the first draft that he did for Rolling Thunder, two things immediately leapt out. One is that Charlie Rain, in his original draft, is a racist character. He is essentially Travis Bickle in a different circumstance. And if anything, he's more overtly racist in it. And, you know, watching the movie, everything that we love about Rolling Thunder, all of the great lines and all of the great set pieces must have come from Haywood Gould, who was the second writer on that film, because, you know, all of the iconic lines from that movie and the great moments, and the fact that Charlie Rain isn't a racist, you know, in the finished film, and he's actually a really likable guy. You really feel for that guy. You know, it's, I'm very glad that we have the Rolling Thunder that we do, but I will say there is one amazing thing in reading that first draft, and I'll pull it up here, but in the first draft of Rolling Thunder, I'll read it directly from the script. It says that Charlie Rain was basically, you know, he was suffering from insomnia. Again, Travis Bickle, right? Says he gets up, the room is dark. Charlie, unable to sleep, gets out of bed and begins dressing. Cut to exterior, drive-in theater. Rain's big red Caddy, top up, pulls into an outdoor theater. The marquee advertises Deep Throat, adults only. Cut to Rain sits behind the wheel watching the film. The light from the screen is reflected on his face. Moans and groans are heard off screen. He takes another hit from his quart of J&B. Turning to his left, Rain looks into the cars parked nearby. He sees dark forms engaged in various stages of necking and petting. Feeling someone staring at him, he turns to look to his left. There, two cars away, sits a young man hunched in the front seat with a beer can in his hand. The young punk's face is gaunt and drained of color. He wears a green plaid Western shirt and army jacket. Those who have read another script of mine titled Taxi Driver will recognize this young man. His name is Travis Bickle. Travis and Rain stare each other down for a moment, two fuses slowly burning down.
Wow.
I really, really wish that scene existed.
Yeah, I mean, now that you've brought, like, 'cause I didn't know a lot about Rolling Thunder. I guess, is this on the Shout Factory release? I need
don't know if I think I do have that one.
There, the screenplay is actually, I found it online.
Is it on there?
Yeah, okay. I don't think it's on the disc, but they reference it. It's funny, Schrader apparently doesn't care much for the finished film because he said that, you know, when he wrote his original draft, he wrote a movie about racism, and they ultimately turned it into a racist film because at the end of it, you know, he races
into... It really doesn't feel like him.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Now that I think about it, like, when I think about it, like, it felt... It's still great, but it's still... It kind of borderlines on... a lot of the other revenge vigilante movies you saw of that time, you know, it just feels like Death Wish, just a little cooler, you know, just a little better.
Oh, absolutely.
With you know, because a little in the vein, Tommy. It just never felt completely Paul Schrader to me. So that makes so much sense to me now because I don't think Paul was interested in that stuff.
Like, No. The big shootout at the end, I think, is something he seriously took issue with because he called, again, he said, you know, his original draft was about racism, and then the final movie is just a racist film because ultimately you have the two heroes racing into, you know, a Mexican brothel and gunning down, you know, a lot of Mexican guys. Now, I don't know that that's my reading of the movie. I don't necessarily see it as a racist film. I mean, ultimately all of the aggressors.
All white guys, right?
Yeah, exactly, you know.
Yeah.
It was James Best from Dukes of Hazzard. I mean...
Yeah. Well, I think they were trying to, the producers were playing it safe and saying, we got to make this guy likable. Because it's kind of like when you talked about them changing the character, like reading the original novel for First Blood.
Yes.
And, you know, John Rambo was kind of a dick. I mean, he deserved everything he got in many ways because he was giving it right back to that sheriff.
Oh, absolutely.
I didn't do nothing. I'm just a veteran and you're mistreating me. And not like he was like egging the guy on and asking for it.
He is a straight up killer in it too.
Yeah. He's just a murdering. Like he just killed a lot of people in cold blood. And, you know, I think, from what I understand, like, of course, Stallone is a Republican, and he didn't want the military to look bad, which that book is an anti-military book. I mean, it's an anti-war book. And being Stallone and being, you know, his politics, he insisted that they not make John Rambo make soldiers look damaged or not to appear... I can't remember if there was any racism in it, if he was racist, but John Rambo was not the all-American hero that he became in the movies. I mean, he's still, you know, the dark character anyway in the movies, but he was so different in the novel.
Well, I remember, too, like, reading the book, like, he wasn't so much a bastard as somebody, I think, who sort of... you know, went into combat mode too. Like when he starts killing everybody, it is because I think he's back in the jungle in a way. Like, I don't think he registers that he is killing cops necessarily. And it is weird though. I mean, he is much more of he isn't the hero of the book. Like, weirdly enough, Teasel is, and Teasel is much more of a sympathetic character. And there's that great line at the end of it where both of them die. You know, I think somebody, either he kills Rambo or somebody else kills Rambo, which is, you know, the first time I read the book was after I'd seen all of the movies, so that was a huge shock. But then Teasel actually being a relatively sympathetic character, and as he bleeds out at the end, he talks about how he dies with, you know, his heart flooding with love for the kid, you know, the kid being Rambo or whatever. You know, he was this older veteran, and he did have a certain amount of sympathy for this younger kid who was in a different war. But there have been so many great movies and so many great books and so much great art to have come out of that, you know, really, really terrible war. So,
some of the best stuff. I mean, I look at the 70s with so much admiration as far as what filmmakers were doing and be able to do, because now they just can't do that anymore. You see it sometimes, but it's so rare. And, you know, in the 70s, a lot of the directors will say that, you know, we were just allowed to do what we wanted. The producers and the studios trusted the artists, and they didn't try to stick in. They let us make our films, tell our stories. And it was one of the first times where they were allowed to cross lines that they weren't allowed to cross earlier. You know, like, that's why you got movies like Last House on the Left, or, and no, it's not a studio film, but, you know, where there were no limits to what could be done and shown, what subject could be touched on. They were allowed to be political. They were not tied down to those restrictions that filmmakers from the 40s and 50s and 60s were, early 60s were tied down to. And that's why you had this explosion of these amazing young directors and storytellers who had no shackles on, you know, where they made Taxi Driver, they were able to make the movie they wanted to make. Today, Taxi Driver, I don't know if it could be made. I don't think it would work. I don't think people would go see it.
It would be a straight-to-VOD release, probably. People would talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, like, film fans would find it, but it wouldn't be it wouldn't be sort of a cultural touchstone like the original must have been.
But it is, it's influenced so many films. I mean, you just see it all over. Like, you know, 1 Hour Photo is definitely in there with the Taxi Driver influence, I feel, with Robin Williams. I think Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh, absolutely.
Was definitely a Taxi Driver. The obvious one, Dead Man's Shoes, the Shane Meadows movie with Patty Considine, which is one of my favorite films of the 2000s. Totally underrated. It's just and what I love about that film is how it was one of the only times I've ever seen, like, it came out around the same time that, like, James Wan's Death Sentence came out.
Yes.
And, I love James. I've grown to really like James Wan, but I didn't really like Death Sentence. I need to revisit it. But I remember there was that movie. There was a film called The Horseman.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Where, that movie's incredible, too.
Remember
unbelievably
the Horseman?
Brutal.
Yeah. And, those movies made Death Sentence look like crap. It made it like Hollywood crap, because there was. One of the things I loved about Dead Man's Shoes was the bad guys in it were so human. They were not stylized at all. There's that, like, he scares those guys so bad. He's intimidated them so bad that they won't leave each other's side. They're they're so scared of this guy that, you know, they go to the bathroom while their friend's taking a crap. They don't care. They're like, they will not be left alone because this guy scares them that much. And I love that humanity that they brought to the gang, that in any other movie of this type, the gang guys would have been just cookie cutter, you know, tough guys and would have gone down in a blaze of glory. But these guys were frightened to death of this man. And at, you know, he gets to the end, and he's also human as well. You know, he breaks down and says, "My brother, I keep hearing him. I don't want to ruin it for anybody who hasn't seen it."
Yeah, it is.
Haven't seen Dead Man's Shoes, go rent it. Yeah.
Yeah, it is great. And is it Patty Considine who stars?
Patty Considine. Yeah, he was just great in it. I've been a fan ever since I saw. I like him anyway, but like that movie really made me a fan of his.
And you mentioned
and
The Horseman too.
I hope
and that's
he makes. Horseman is phenomenal. It's you know, it's like it's either you watch Horseman or you watch Taken. It's kind of like those like Taken is the Hollywood, you know, fantasy thing where Horseman is so visceral and real, where, you know, it's got father getting revenge on people, and it's sloppy, and he's not a killer. In every movie, in every Hollywood movie, the guy who's getting revenge is like ex-military. Special set of skills. Where this guy is just like some exterminator, garbage man.
He's got a hammer.
Going out.
That's
kill.
It.
Yeah. And he's going out and getting revenge, and it's not pretty. And it's not perfect. And that's what I love about that film was how, just it's grounded in reality. And I just love that about it.
And he feels much more like a human being to the lead character in The Horseman. I'm forgetting the actor's name, but he was brilliant in it. But yeah, he feels like he doesn't feel like the Hollywood father, the wronged man. You know, he doesn't feel like Liam Neeson. And I'm not knocking Liam Neeson. I think Taken's perfectly fun. But you're right. Like when you watch something like that, you are watching a fantasy. When you watch something like The Horseman, at times it feels almost like a documentary. It feels unbelievably real at times.
Well, it's what's interesting about it is, like, when you watch something like Taken, that's total. I don't know how you want to call it. It's fan service. It's satisfying to the viewer. Like, they're living, through that character, and like, yeah, get the bad guy, kill the bad guy. But I think it's too easy. And I think it's more glorifying the violence than making it. When you make violence real, and I think I mentioned Last House, and that's one of the things I love about Last House on the Left. It's not the greatest movie. I'm not a huge fan, although I'm a big Wes Craven fan, having made Confession, and that was kind of my love letter to that guy. But one thing I loved about Last House on the Left when I heard about them making it was how, I think Wes said, he and Sean went and saw The Good, the Bad, and Ugly, which is one of my favorite films of all time as well. But he said, we watched The Good, the Bad, and Ugly, and we're watching people being shot, and it's glorified. The Westerns, it was all glorified. People would attack Last House on the Left for glorifying violence, but he's like, we didn't glorify it. We showed how ugly and real violence is. We showed the consequences of what violence really is. And we show it in the killers. When they murder the girls, you can see how disgusted they are with themselves when they're washing the blood off themselves. You can see it's just far more real, and it doesn't make it pretty or cool to kill people. Whereas you watch John Wayne or Clint Eastwood or whatever, and you're rooting. He's shooting down four guys. You're like, yeah. You see Schwarzenegger shooting down 100 guys at command. You're like, yeah, go get them. But like, the audience doesn't care about the victims or anything else. It's like, that's the definition of glorification of violence. But something like Last House or Dead Man's Shoes or Taxi Driver shows the weight of what real violence causes and how it affects everyone. And it's not pretty. It's not cool. And
he is certainly the hero at the end of that movie. When he's talking through. You could argue that he might be a hero because he was saving the girl. Again, I think he was probably doing it because he wanted to. That was the main reason. But he isn't. Of course, the movie predates like all of the 80s action films. But he. It's sloppy what he does when he goes in. He gets shot in the throat. He gets shot in the arm,
He screws up a lot.
But I got to ask, talking about that ending, I got to ask your opinion. The final moment there during that scene, we have Iris crying. We have all of the people dead around him. We have the cops come in. Travis is bleeding from his throat and, the gunshot wound in his arm. And he puts his bloody finger to his head and, he's acting like he's trying to kill himself, like, psh, psh, But then he relaxes and he sort of stares upwards and he's still for a moment and his eyes are just kind of open. And the camera, and it should be noted, I mean, the movie is almost an entirely subjective movie. We're almost entirely over Travis's shoulder or seeing through his eyes, not literally, but I mean, we're seeing the movie through his eyes for the most part throughout the entire film. I think there are like
shot of him are his eyes.
Yeah. But I think there are like maybe two scenes, Betsy and Tom and then Iris and Matthew, which, don't quite fit in with that. But I mean, for the most part, I would say it's probably a pretty subjective movie. And then when he's on the couch and it looks like he's bleeding out, the point of view goes high, the sort of God's eye view of the carnage, and it sort of just dreamily kind of floats away. And maybe it's
Bernard Herrmann's score at that moment is very dreamy and fantasy, that's another thing you brought up. Was it is from his perspective most of the film, and the only time they break that is with Sport and Iris when they dance, because we do see the scene between Albert Brooks and we see their scenes in the campaign office, but Travis is watching them. But when Sport is with her dancing, that was Travis was nowhere around, and that was the one thing I think Paul Schrader had a problem with, that Scorsese had to kind of convince him to let him do it.
I kind of wish he had.
Because, yeah. I think it was something that Harvey, you know, Harvey had done so many movies with Scorsese at that point. They had been working together for so long, and Harvey was kind of, up until that point, his muse. He was always kind of when he played in Mean Streets, he's practically playing Scorsese, where to the point that Scorsese does his voiceovers. It does Harvey Keitel's voiceovers in Mean Streets. And I don't know if it was, I think Harvey came up with that idea. He wanted to do that in like rehearsals, or he pitched that idea to Marty, that he wanted to have this kind of tender moment with Iris to show, yeah, like I said, is it better without it or with it? It does kind of make you see the relationship between those two more, to where, you know, like you said, does she really want to go? Does she really want to be saved? Is this guy treating her good? But of course, we know he's not treating her good, because we see him talking to Travis, and he's talking about her body, and he's talking about, oh, you ain't never had nothing like this. She's 12 years old, man. You know, and it's like, oh, it's this guy is a piece of trash. Yeah. He don't care about her. Yeah, see, he's completely full of it and completely getting what he wants out of her.
And even if Travis had been somehow around during that scene, if he had been eavesdropping or something, I wonder if it might have, you know, strengthened the movie a bit, because it does sort of, you know, it does take away from the notion that this is entirely Travis's film and from his point of view, you know, that everything else in the movie sort of supports. But even down to that shot, you know, when we're sort of floating away, and you're right, the Herman music comes up, and it's kind of dreamy in a way. And then, you know, from that point on, we discover that Travis goes into the hospital, and he's revered as a hero by the media and, you know, Iris's parents. And Betsy takes a ride in the cab, and everything seems kind of good between them again. And, you know, she's interested in him. And it's kind of a very idealized ending for Travis. And one wonders if, you know, maybe it's a death dream of some sort. You know, this sort of very Occurrence at Owl Creek ending, where a dying Travis imagines a perfected version of his life. You know, do you think that's the case, or am I reaching too far, do you think?
Well, I think in all art, you know, there's always, you know, any option or any road is possible. It's how you perceive it. It's how you see it. I think it's definitely a possibility. I don't know if that's what they intended or what they're trying to project. I think they were definitely being kind of ominous when they composed the ending. But yeah, it definitely could be his continued fantasy of, oh, now they're going to know me. Now they're going to love me. Now Betsy's going to love me. Now everybody's going to love me. This is what I want. I wanted acceptance. I wanted relationship. I wanted to be noticed. I wanted to be appreciated. I wanted to be, because I am a loser and nobody cares, I am invisible and I will never amount to anything. Now I will matter, which is really what the movie is about. And that's what, you know, I think that's why people connect with it, because everybody wants to be accepted. Everybody wants to be special. Everybody wants to be noticed. Most people don't want to be invisible or left alone. Particularly, we do. We don't want to be left alone. We don't want to be, but, you know, especially in America as well. You know, this is like I had some rehearsals with some actors today on my next film, and I had one of the actors. He was kind of giving some other people some, you know, lessons, and we were talking about how in America, you know, it's this whole fixation on celebrity and fame. To where, you know, I won't get into what we were talking about, but that idea of here it is like that, like, especially now, it's even worse. Of I want to be famous. I want to be known. I want to be recognized. And, you know, maybe there's a little narcissism in Travis as well. But then he keeps saying that, you know, I don't think we should be self-attentive. But he's completely a contradiction. I guess that's why she says, you know, he reminds her of that Kris Kristofferson song, you know, you're a walking contradiction, partly truth, partly fiction. I mean, there's so many things going on with Travis where he does contradict himself a lot. He is two different people at many times.
In a very subtle way, very Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, it's so exactly. That's why it's so. It keeps getting watched and it keeps getting analyzed. That's why there's so many books about the film. So many critics have talked about it, and why it continues to live on, because there's just so much. It's universal. I think a lot more people identify with that loneliness than they want to admit. I think a lot of us have been there. And you know, I think Schrader was saying that Schrader had been there. And that's why he wrote it. He had been in New York. He was living in his car, and he just kind of realized that he hadn't spoken to people in weeks. And here he is in New York City, the biggest city, the most populated city in the world, and he's completely alone and isolated. How does that happen? And Scorsese talked about that. He had been fit in, or I don't, you know, that isolation, that I'm not like them. And again, I think that has a lot to do with being an artist as well, you know, because we just think differently and see that I have a real heart, even to this day. Now that I've done conventions and done films and had to be forced into spotlights and being forced to public speaking and all that and do, you know, panels and things, I've come out of it a little bit, but I'm still that guy who would rather be at home by himself watching TV, you know, or I would rather not engage in people. I'd rather not people. And I don't know how to talk to people. Like you know, people want to talk about sports, or they want to talk about the cars, or they want to talk about chicks and all that. And I just like that. Well, like most guy talk is. And I'm like, I have no interest. I'm in the movies and art and comics and shit, you know? So when we, and I think you'll probably relate to this as well, being, I imagine you're just like me, because you're doing this podcast and you're in the horror. When we meet somebody like ourselves, because you and I, we could probably continue to talk for the next 10 hours if we wanted to.
Absolutely.
Because that's how it is. You get on the phone, or you meet somebody who gets you, and you just connect, and you could talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. And I think maybe that's what Travis needed. He needed a friend. He needed a friend who was in the guns and shit.
I wonder what Travis Bickle's friend, like what his, you know, what does Travis Bickle's best friend look like, you know?
Who knows? In a mirror, I guess. I don't think the guy had any capabilities of finding anybody. Because, again, he's boring. He has no interest, like you talked about. He has no hobby. What do you talk about? And I think that's something that's very important. Again, going back to the horror thing of why horror fans are a little, that cathartic thing is that we have something to fill our time and that makes us happy that we can retreat to. I can go back to my, it's like that song Weezer had where, you know, in my room where like I have my D&D and I have my X-Men and I have all this in my room where I can go with that. And I have a place to escape. Travis has no escape. He has nowhere to go. As an artist, I can take things that are bothering me and I can put it into a script or a drawing or a story. I have a release. I have a place to exercise that stuff, to get all those demons out. And if you don't, those are the people who snap. Those are the people who do things. They have no outlet. They have no interest. They have nothing. You know, find something to do. Make, you know, get toy trains, have a football, fantasy league, whatever you have to do. Occupy your mind. Have something to do. And that's the thing. Travis doesn't have anything to occupy his mind or his time. So he just, like, walks around, goes to porno movies, and drives a taxi all night because he has nowhere to go, has nothing to do, and has no interest, and is completely void and boring.
And as a result, he becomes
probably
a monster.
Yeah, that's probably the mechanics of what turns someone to acting out, because they have no outlet. They have nothing else to do but to brood and to fester until something has to explode. They have to do something. And is it going to be something positive or negative? And in his case, it was both. He was doing something negative, but also someone was helped by it, or people projected that it was somebody that he helped. Again, there's so many possibilities of things you could talk about this character in this film. And that's, again, why it's my favorite and why it's still so, you know, highly regarded.
All right. Well, sir, I think that's just about our time. Mr. Miller, thanks so much for being on the show. Now, now, can I ask, where can folks find you at online, and what can we keep an eye out for from you in the future?
Oh, well, I don't have a – I have a website. It's called RebelRouserArt.com. I haven't updated it in years, so there's nothing – there's not a lot of new stuff on there, but I do have some people I've hooked up with who are currently putting a website together, but we don't have if you Google Nathan Thomas Milner, a lot of stuff comes up. I mostly operate out of Facebook. I'm on there quite frequently sharing what I'm doing in art and film. As far as film, I did the Volumes of Blood series, which the first one is on Blu-ray right now. I think it's on Amazon and Legos Course Films. And then we just did Volumes of Blood 2 Horror Stories, which is coming out, I think, in the summer from Petrie Entertainment on Blu-ray and DVD. I did two segments in that. There's an anthology series, Volumes of Blood is. And I'm about to make another fan film. I really didn't want to make another fan film. I made Confession of Fred Krueger because it was kind of this 30-year journey, because I'd been wanting to make that, see that story for 30 years. It wasn't going to happen, so I went and made it kind of for me kind of thing. And I said, that's it. I'm not going to do any fan films, because there's a stigma with fan films. People don't really use or respect fan films. So I was kind of like, I'm never going to do that again. But then I got a call in February from a producer and some people who I really respect and wanted to work with. And they had gotten the idea to make a Star Wars fan film and for charity, because they had done a lot of charity work with the 501st, which is kind of the Star Wars cosplay organization, who do charity events and things for, you know, kids with cancer and things. And they had done that, and they wanted to do a film to help raise money for the charities. And they were wanting if I wanted to be involved, and I ended up becoming a writer and director on it.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm shooting that in about 3 weeks. That's where I was doing that today with the rehearsals. So that's what I'll be doing next, and we're hoping to have that done and out by the summer. So that's the next thing I'm doing. I'm also doing kind of really busy at this moment, because I'm doing that film and pre-production on it, and at the same time I'm working on the Leslie Vernon comic book.
Really?
Behind the yeah. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you know, Behind the Mask, they've been trying to get the sequel made for 10 years now. It's a 10-year anniversary. And I had met Scott about 5 years ago or so. And they were trying to get the sequel made and, you know, doing Kickstarters and things. And they didn't get the money they needed. But I had done some artwork for them to try to – I kind of donated some work to try to get money for them. Like I said, here, take this art, sell it, try to get money. I want to see your film, because I think Behind the Mask was just a brilliant film.
Agreed.
And it's one of my favorites. And they're good guys. I mean, Scott's a good guy. The writer, David, is awesome. I've gotten to work with David a couple times, and Nathan's an awesome, Nathan Basil. I guess I'm saying his name right. I guess Basil. But they're just a great team. I thought it was a brilliant film. And they contacted me a couple months ago saying they wanted to do a comic book version of it, of the script, to maybe help get awareness for the film, maybe get a little spark going for the 10th anniversary. And I want to know if I was interested in that. At first, I actually said no, because I was so busy. And doing comic books is so time-consuming. It's a task. It's a dedication. You have to pretty much do that and nothing else. Here, I'm trying to make a movie and do this thing. But it was just one of those opportunities where I got to work with people I like and respect, and on a project that I myself wanted to see, as I've been wanting to see. I hadn't read the script until they gave it to me for this project, and it's a great script. It's funny, it's smart, just like the first one was. And I've been drawing it for the last month. And, you know, we did the Indiegogo, and they got the money. So that's what I'm doing every day. that's what I'll be doing in the morning. I'll be drawing Leslie Vernon and working on Star Wars. And that's what I'll be doing for the next 6 months for Star Wars and the next year for Leslie Vernon. So it's going to take a year to do it all.
I can't wait to see both. All right. Well, sir, thank you again. And thanks to all you listeners out there. As always, please make certain to rate and review us on iTunes if you haven't already. Subscribe, share, let your friends know about us. And until next time, folks, thanks so much and have a great weekend.
You're only as healthy as you feel.